We're going to be in Luke 15 this morning. We were in Luke 15 last week. We're going to be in Luke 15 this week. And we're going to be in Luke 15 next week. I think it's the reason it's an enduring parable is because you cannot exhaust the teachings of Jesus. So for 3 weeks, we're going to be in one parable. This whole summer, we've been committed to many of Jesus's parables. And if you weren't here last week, or maybe it was a hard week and you've forgotten, let me give you a quick recap of the ground we covered. Okay, here's what we learned. The parable cannot be told from one perspective. The parable in Luke 15 has to hold in tension all three characters. So we talked about the younger brother, the younger prodigal. And we talked about how when he went to his father and said, I want all my inheritance, essentially what he was saying is, Dad, I wish you were dead. I want everything that you have. I don't want you. I want to live life how I want to live, and I want to do it my way. And that is exactly what he does. And he brings shame to his family by asking for his inheritance before his father is able or willing to give it to him. And he's not so much repenting in the beginning of the story as he is coming to his senses. Being sensible is not the same thing as repenting. He realizes he's in a tight spot, and if he goes back to live with his father, he can at least live as a staff member on his family's farm community, and he can have a better life, not as a son, but as an employee, than if he continues to live the life that he's leading. And so as he's coming to his father sees him and welcomes him, and he restores him as a full member of the family. He calls him his son. You remember that prodigal doesn't just mean wayward returning or a wayward individual returning to where they came from. Prodigal means someone who recklessly spends, who lavishly gives away. So in every sense of the word, all three characters in Luke 15 are prodigals. Only the father is willing to recklessly or lavishly spend outside of himself for the sake of others. But we also talked about the elder brother. The elder brother has his fists clenched and his arms folded as the party is starting to happen, right? As the music is starting to play, it's like you can see the father on his way into the party, like, aren't you going to? And the older brother has his arms folded and says, how could you? And he says this. You can look in Luke 15 here. He says, I've slaved for you. How long have I worked for you? And then he says what we do in family systems all the time. When we want to disassociate ourselves with the person in our family whom we're upset with, the older brother says, this son of yours. Right? We do that when our children let us down. We say to our spouse, well, he's your son. Or she's your daughter. Or when he does something well, oh, he's my son, or she's my, he says, your son. And you feel his righteous indignation rising in the story, and the story ends on a cliffhanger. Will he or won't he join the party? But really, we said last week that the story is about God. Jesus is trying to help us understand the God whom he embodies. Hebrews 1 and 4, Colossians 1 says that Jesus is the perfect representation of God. Jesus is trying to drive home to these students, these disciples, if you want to see God, you have to consider the God that I'm coming to embody and teach about. In verse 20 of chapter 15, the Bible says that the Father sees his Son coming and his filled with compassion. The only other time in the entire Gospel of Luke that word is used is in Luke chapter 10, when the Good Samaritan sees a Jew beat up by the side of the road and he's moved in his gut. That's what the word means. It means like someone sucker punches you and you can't breathe. You're so overcome with emotion that you have to do something. And Jesus says, this is the Father. It's not just the Father who says, oh yeah, you can come back and live here. This is a father who runs to meet you and gives you everything that was already yours and then more. A ring, a robe, sandals, the best filet mignon. And Jesus says, this is the Father. This is what the Father's like. We also talked about how Jesus then becomes the elder brother in the story of creation. Jesus is going to be for humanity what the elder brother could not be for the younger brother, because it's easier if you have an elder brother rooting for you to come back to the Father. But the younger brother has to come back without the acceptance of the older brother. And so Jesus, in his death, in his resurrection, and in the expansion of the church, is going to show humanity what it looks like when you have someone who is interceding, someone who wants to bring you back to the heart of the Father. Okay, now here's the only problem with all of that. All of it's true. But the problem is, when we tell those stories that way, we lose sight of one thing that is absolutely true of human experience. Where you read something shapes how you read it. Sometimes some of you will send me a long, theologically complex email, and I will open it as Lucas is throwing a Nerf football at my head and I'm trying to watch SportsCenter. Are you with me? Right? So where you read something shapes what you experience. So I hit the delete. No, I don't do that. Okay. But you know what I'm saying? If you pick up a newspaper in a really crowded area, you're probably not going to pick the most complex article. You're probably going for the comics or the sports section. Because where you are shapes what you read, how you experience it. Let me give you a couple of examples of this. In Luke chapter 4, Jesus makes this grand pronouncement, this big vision statement. He says, quoting Isaiah, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me to preach good news to the captives, to bring hope to the poor, recovery of sight to the blind, to set the prisoners free, to change everything as you know it to be, to turn the world upside down." Guess how that passage sounds in a prison versus reading it Sunday morning at Otter Creek. Or how about in Mark chapter 5 and Mark chapter 6, when Jesus encounters a woman, he's on his way to do ministry, and ministry breaks out, when a woman who has been sick, hemorrhaging blood for at least half of her life, touches Jesus and she's healed. How does that story sound read at Vanderbilt ER at 2 in the morning? Than if you read it at Otter Creek on a Sunday morning. What I'm saying is sometimes we don't pay attention to where we read the Bible shapes how we experience it. It shapes what we think the Bible is saying and doing. And here's my proof. You're in Luke 15. Look at the first two verses with me. "Now all the tax collectors and sinners were coming near to listen to him. And the Pharisees and the scribes were grumbling, saying, 'This fellow welcomes sinners, and what's worse, he eats with them.'" So right before Luke is going to give us three important stories, he tells you the very reason Jesus is going to tell the parables that he tells. And this is what we miss. We think the third parable is the same as the first two. But the third parable turns the first two completely upside down. Watch how this works. In the first two parables, this is what you have in common. Something is enjoyed, a possession, a connection. Something is lost. Something is searched for. Something is found, coin in a sheep. And a celebration takes place. Right? It's like a very predictable pattern. And we think the reason Jesus is saying that is because of what Luke captures in the first two verses. This fellow welcomes sinners and eats with them. Jesus is going to find the lost coin, and he's going to find the lost sheep. That's why for centuries we've interpreted the parable of the prodigal as about only prodigal younger brothers, bikers, tax collectors, prostitutes, sinners. There's only one problem with that. We haven't read the whole story. The story in Luke 15 of the prodigal family should end as the party is breaking out, the older brother running in, but it doesn't end there. as someone said to me this morning, it's actually quite frustrating that you don't know if the older brother actually goes into the party. You don't know what his decision will be. That's because Jesus knew, as these stories would be told 30 and 40 and 80 and 2,000 years later, that in any context, there would be older brothers and sisters who would have to make the exact same decision. I can be a moral insider and in my piety pretend like I'm better than the immoral outsider, the younger brother, when really the Father says, both of you are far from my heart. So let me think very practically with you. If you're thinking, well, how would you even measure? Like, how would you even know if you're an elder brother or sister? Let me give you just some very practical observations from the Gospel of Luke and just kind of my experience in church life, okay? The first one is that here's how you know if you're an elder brother or sister. You prefer comfort and the security of what you know versus the unknown of God's future. You would rather, most times in your life, play it safe than to take a risk. I love the older brother in this sense. He's not just thinking, well, you know, I could go off and do that like my brother did, but I've got Comcast here, I've got Bluebell ice cream, I've got like my favorite spot on the couch. Like, why would I give up all that when it's actually a pretty good life? And I think one of the things the father calls out his elder son is, you think because you've stayed here, because you've stayed where you're supposed to be, that that automatically means you're becoming the person I want you to be. When in fact, when the moment reveals his true character, his heart is very similar to his younger brother's. It's about what he thought he wanted and what he thought he deserved to get from his father, not his father. That's the first test. Another test, I think one that makes us really uncomfortable. Elder brothers and sisters only like to be the only children. They don't want other brothers and sisters in the family, especially if they're going to be younger brothers and sisters who are messy, who make things complicated, who bring, you know, weird pasts into the family story. Elder brothers and sisters are fine being the only children. You remember how the Bible starts? God going to Cain, who's killed Abel, and he says, where's your brother? And Cain says, am I my brother's keeper? And the answer is essentially, yes. Like, I didn't make you to live by yourself. I didn't make you to live with people who were just like you, who worked just like you. I made you to live in community. That message never died. In this parable, Jesus is saying, if you're in a family, there are other siblings, and you don't get to be the only child. But probably the most important test is this. Elder brothers and sisters cling to a truncated view of sin so that we don't have to deal with the sin that exists in our life. What I mean is this. The elder brother considered himself to be moral and righteous, and Jesus says that is exactly the problem. Do you remember that other time in Luke where Jesus says this? He actually says it two times in Luke. He says, it's not the healthy who need a doctor, it's the, right? He's not being literal there. What he's saying is everyone's sick, only some people are willing to admit it. So the healthy don't need a doctor because they're healthy, right? It's only those who recognize it. And the elder brother can look at the younger brother and say, well, it's so obvious. I mean, he lived in Vegas. He spent all that he had. He's been divorced 5 times. What a train wreck he is, Dad. Right, Dad? Dad, I'm so sorry. At least you got me. But then when the moment comes to find out where the elder brother's heart really is, he refuses to celebrate the return because he has placed his identity in his own family performance. And this is a very explicit, direct judgment of finding your identity in any place other than your relationship with the Father. Not the Father's stuff, not the Father's blessing, not the Father's house, but the Father himself. This is what causes the rupture in the first century world when Jesus is inviting people into a relationship with God. You don't have to have the temple. You don't have to have the priests. You don't have... What will you do with me? So I said last week, what I want to do is be very practical to our life together this summer. And I think there's something emerging kind of within our church that's very exciting, and I just want to share it with you. You will remember that a year ago, when Doug Sanders, who's one of the most Jesus people I've ever been around, when he decided that his call to ministry, not just at Otter Creek, but his call to ministry was going to take a different shape, the elders, along with Mike Runcie, decided to take some time and do some evaluation. Part of that evaluation was to form a think tank group made up of Otter Creekers. Part of that evaluation was Mike Runcie and I did several different listening group conversations with elders, MCC, different people in the church, ministry team, staff members. And we talked about, what do we do well at Otter Creek? We do some things really well. What do we struggle in? There are some things that we struggle with. And out of that conversation, a conviction among the elders and Mike emerged, and that conviction was this very practically, that related to Doug's ministry, that it was crazy to expect one person to be able to focus on reaching out as Doug did so well, works of justice, works of compassion, works with the work with those who are poor in our city. But also Doug was responsible for reaching in life groups. He worked with me on adult education. And when you have a church of 1,400 or 1,500 people, it just makes it really hard for one person to help other adults be disciples in those two areas. So their decision was this, not that it was a silver bullet, but that it was a step in the right direction, that we would try and focus our energies on being much more intentional about reaching in through life groups and adult education. And that's why Eric Livingston joined our staff just about a month and a half, 2 months ago. Now, I want you to know the challenge that Eric is up against. And by the way, he's moving all of his stuff to Nashville as we speak. That's why I'm bringing it up while he's not here. Oh, he is here. You're back. Okay, sorry. I had your date wrong. And he appeared. That's how good he is. We have 1,550 people who consider Otter Creek their church home. 1,550 people. That's not people who just come at Christmas or Easter. Those are people who are in some way regularly in orbit of this church community. Of those 1,550 people, which represent about 580 family units, only one-third are involved in a life group. Now, we know we're not going to get 1,500 people in a life group. We're realists. But we have two-thirds, almost 70% of our church, who are not connected, at least formally, in ways that we know when a fire happens or cancer happens or something happens in life. If you don't have 3 to 7 people that you're connected and trust, it makes it really hard. So Eric's challenge, and he's going to be meeting with life group leaders and prospective leaders the first 2 Sundays in August, his challenge is to help us create energy and momentum to really understand how important it is to be connected. And it may not be a traditional life group like you've thought of. It may be a Bible study. It may be an accountability group. It may look a different way. But that was part of the response the elders and Mike Runcie had to that particular part of our vision of reaching in, of being in community together. And let me make this observation. This is, again, if you're a visitor to Otter Creek, this is just like really practical family stuff right now. I don't apologize for that because sometimes my dad used to call family meetings. So this is kind of just an update on where we are. An observation. I think historically, we as a church have been good at challenging other adults to help raise and disciple our children and our students. I think that's a huge legacy. I think David Rubio and David Knox and Janet and Melanie and many others have been a huge part of recruiting adult disciples to help disciple our children and help to equip parents to disciple their children. But here's, I think, one glaring weakness that we have as a church. And I'm just saying it from my chair. You don't have to agree with me. I don't think we always know what it means to be adult disciples who call other adults to be disciples. I think it's part of our individualism. I think it's part of our wealth. I think it's part of our affluence that we think, well, we won't bother that person. But the 11-year-old, yeah, they need to be discipled. They need to be taught the story of Jesus. And so as a second part of this, the elders and Mike decided that they were also going to call someone to help serve as a catalyst, a leader, an equipper. Not a messiah, but a catalyst to help us think about what does it mean to be a church that takes seriously being disciples so that other adults can be disciples, not just being passionate about our children and our students becoming disciples. And Mike Runcie and a think tank group that I'm going to introduce you to, some of their members here in just a moment, they spent countless meetings and hours in prayer, study, talking with other churches about how could we best serve Otter Creek with this particular role. And I'm very excited that in addition to Eric, Rob Touchstone, who's lived in Nashville for a long time, he's been on staff at the Tusculum Church of Christ. He teaches at Lipscomb. He's the co-founder of The Well in Green Hills that some of you are familiar with. In just a few weeks, he will be joining our staff as our discipleship minister, our missional discipleship minister. And his task will be in two areas. In many ways, he's going to kind of follow the same footprints of Doug Sanders. And in some ways, he's going to blaze different trails. But his task will be this, to help us as a church, myself included, especially, to think very carefully and intentionally about how we try to be a church culture that takes seriously our mission to be disciples and not elder brothers. Because elder brothers are content as long as they get to stay the elder brother. But we have a whole city of younger brothers and sisters. And as a church of elder brothers and sisters, we have an opportunity, I think, uniquely to have someone challenge us. And this is going to be his primary role. He's going to work with our existing compassion and justice ministries, the stuff we've cared about for a long time, from the Wayne Reed Center to Made in the Streets to Living Water, whom he already works with. He's going to be a catalyst and a voice for both those things we've done and things we haven't even dreamed of yet. And then he's also going to help us and challenge us to create different kind of intentional discipleship communities in Brentwood, in Nashville, in Green Hills, in Franklin, in Nolensville. And some of that will be through The Well. And you're going to hear a lot more about this on August 18th and 25th when Eric and Rob and I take both Sundays to do a teaching time to invite some of you into this. Some of you are deeply connected. Please don't hear this as, oh, they're asking me to do one thing. That's not who we're talking to. We want to challenge those of you who have not found your place, who have not really found a way to come alive in expressing your faith, who want to explore a different life of a different part of the life of following Jesus. So I want to ask at this time, those who were on the think tank group, about half are here this Sunday. If you were on that exploratory team that helped Mike Runcie, would you come up as we watch this video welcome from Rob Touchstone? Come up and join me, please.
I wish we could be there with you in person today, but I wanted to say a quick hello to our new Otter Creek church family. Amy, Anna, John, Mark, and I are so excited to begin working with you and the great things that you're already doing at Otter Creek. What a blessing it is for us to be able to join your staff and your church family to begin reaching out to our community in Nashville. I can't wait to begin this new role, and I am so excited about what God is doing as together we try and plant missional communities all over Nashville and to reach out to the least of these, to bring His grace and healing to those who are impoverished, and to bring justice where there is need. And God is going to do so many things as we work together to reach into the lives of so many together around Nashville. Our first Sunday will be two Sundays from today, so we can't wait to begin meeting you in person, and we will see you then.
again, a year ago, when the elders in the MCC were thinking about this year, they were very intentional about praying through this, about in some meetings arguing through this, which can be healthy. And I just know, as you get to know Eric's heart in working with life groups and mentoring and adult education, as you get to know Rob's heart, I think you're going to see what Mike and I and the elders saw, and that is we are passionate that we want to be just as good and just as excellent in discipling adults as David and David are with our students, as Janet and Melanie are with our children. That's where this is coming from. And we ask that you, if you have questions, come see Mike, come see me, talk to one of our shepherds. But again, we're going to take very intentional time in August to kind of unpack what this might look like and the ways that you as a church body can be a part of this. We ask for your prayers. We ask for your questions. Challenge us. Not that I needed to say that, but you know what I mean. Challenge us. We want to hear from you. So the team, the advisory team that worked with Mike and the shepherds, Doug and Nan Smith, David and Sarah Wilson, Jim and Dan Arnett, Pat and Cynthia Bennett, Marlene Butler, and Steve Sherman. They gave lots of time and lots of hours talking to different ministers, talking to different churches, reading different material, praying together, trying to think about what could be a next exciting chapter in the life of Otter Creek that can continue to compel us to be true to our vision of reaching up, reaching in, as Eric's going to help us do, and reaching out. Let's pray, and let's stand as we continue our time of worship. God, as a church, we confess that we don't want to be elder brothers and sisters. We don't want to be people who are only concerned about our own little areas, our own little lives, our own little neighborhoods, our own little communities. God, we confess that Jesus has captured our heart to have a passion for all of creation, starting with humanity, God. And God, we know that just as you've started to change us with Next Right Step and the men and the women who are leaving their prodigal lives and joining our community, we know that you have dozens of other stories that are just waiting for us. So God, our prayer is that you would take the faithful efforts of this exploratory team, that you would take the prayers of the shepherds of this church, that you would take the talent and the work of Eric and the talent and the work of Rob, and that you would prepare our hearts for a season of adults being challenged to be disciples. God, we don't want to be church people. We don't want to be religious. We don't want to be pious. We want to be apprenticed to the way of Jesus as we see it in the Gospels. We know this is a huge mountain to climb, but we know that your Holy Spirit will guide us. So God, would you give us courage? Would you give us conviction? Would you give us the mind of Jesus to take the focus off ourselves and to continue to live for this city? And God, may your name alone be glorified and never the Otter Creek Church. And the whole church prayed together.